Okay, so yesterday, in thinking about it, I think the volume of information transfer was extremely high. So to put it in biological terms, all of you have taken what I said yesterday and put it in short-term memory. Right. Now, the ability to recall short-term memory varies with people, but some of you have taken some of that stuff and put it in long-term memory, right? So if that worked, then you're in better shape because you can then recall it. But it's good, but the way around this problem, the way to reactivate your short-term memory and get it to start thinking about transferring it to long-term memory is to repeat, right? Repetition and testing, they say, is the two most important things you can do to get it into long-term memory. So we're not going to test, but we'll repeat. Right? So it's boring to repeat literally, so it's going to sound like a different lecture, but I'm going to start off by repeating. And the other thing I want to do is, now that I've had a chance to talk to some of you, I know that there's a tremendous distribution with a large standard deviation in comprehension. Right? So I'm going to back up a little bit and get some terms on the table that will become useful in the future. And I'm even going to try to pause occasionally and say where I think physicists could play a really important role and where biologists have failed to analyze data in a deep and interesting way. Okay, so we heard that there really are three classes, if you think about it, of genes that you have. If you have approximately 25,000 genes in your genome, the kind of interesting thing that we didn't mention before is that while your genome is 3 × 10^9 base pairs, right? Only 3% of that information in base pairs is actually genes. That's protein genes that encode the information for proteins and genes that encode the information for RNAs. Those are the two kinds of structural elements that go to make up the cell. And only 3% of your information is being actually used for those two classes of genes, RNA and protein. Part of the reason is that there's an awfully heavy load of these retroviruses and retrotransposons, which make up maybe 40 to 55% of the genome information, so that we don't think they contribute. They may contribute in an evolutionary sense. They move. The retrotransposons can move in your genome. That rearranges your genome. That means no two of you are actually alike, given the movement of these retrotransposons as you make eggs or as your parents make eggs or sperm. But nonetheless, even if they speed up evolution, they are not encoding any vital information for your life. then we heard that there were three classes of genes that of this 25,000 that can contribute to the origins of cancer in humans, mostly through mutations. Right. Yeah, that's fine. It's a great time to interrupt.
I don't know much about this, but introns. How much of the 97% are could they be introns or?
Yes. Let's just talk. Yeah, that's a very good thing.
Levine once told me that can have regulatory.
It does. Not only can it does have regulatory effects. But regulatory effects, of course, are not coding. They're regulatory. They're informational effects. Doesn't mean that all 3 × 10^9 base pairs don't contain some information which contributes to you. I'm just talking about the structural information, the RNAs and the proteins. Genes actually, but once we really figured out in higher organisms what the structure of genes was, it was a very big surprise. We figured out very early on the structure of genes in prokaryotes, in bacteria. And they are collinear with their proteins. What do I mean by that? So if you have a typical gene in a bacteria, starts with the codon ATG, right? That makes methionine, that defines the start of a gene, and it ends with the codons UGA, UAA, and U, UAA and UAG. And these are the chain termination codons. That's the end of the gene. That's no the protein stops at that point, right? And this is what I meant by reading frame the other day. Amino acids, amino acid 1, amino acid 2, amino acid N, stop, right? The gene and its protein are collinear. And that became a kind of dogma, part of the dogma as we learned about bacterial genes, prokaryotic genes, virus genes. The information in the DNA was collinear with the information in the protein, and everything seemed fine. So we were rather taken aback when we found out that that wasn't true in higher organisms. So in higher organisms, instead of having a readout that's collinear literally with the protein, we have a gene which has what have come to be called exons. Right. Here's the ATG. Here's the stop. Right. And the information to make the protein is read along here in a collinear fashion. And then it's interrupted by a DNA sequence that does not appear in the protein. And then it picks up again by a sequence that does appear in the protein. And that would be called an exon again. Right? And so this is a gene with four exons. And the interruption of the information actually is called an intron. Right? This actually will be start to become important as we talk about DNA sequencing as a way to get at what cancers are about. Right? Because it's possible to sequence only the exons, and it's possible to sequence the whole genome. And you're getting different information from each of that. Right? So this is the average structure. Right? And remember, I talked about the P16 and off-gene locus. This is a nice locus. Right? P16, the protein P16, which inhibits cyclin D, CDK4, and therefore stops the cell cycle. It's a negative regulator of the cell cycle. It's a major tumor suppressor gene. If you inherit P16 mutations, you'll develop melanomas at an early age. Right? We don't know why it's just melanomas, because P16 works in all kinds of cells. That was one of the quandaries about tissue specificity. And that's this reading frame, with an ATG here and a stop here. Right. And then there was a second, yes?
It stopped at the end of exon?
No, it could be in the middle of the exon, it could be at the end.
And then what happens?
Stop is for stopping protein from being made. But the messenger RNA continues on. And it continues on until the end of the exon, at which time it's cleaved and stopped. Right? So the exon is measuring the messenger RNA, not the actual stop of the protein. And that means that every messenger RNA has at its one end, a leader sequence in, at the other end, a trailer sequence out. And both are regulatory in their properties. Right?
And so typical lengths of those exons? Typical ratio of the lengths?
There aren't typical ratios. You can have two base pair exons, you can have a 20 kilobase exon. 2,000, 20,000 base pairs, right? So genes vary a lot. The largest gene in your genome is for a structural protein of muscle called Duchenne's muscular dystrophy gene. That's megabases, and that's the one I mentioned took 24 hours to transcribe because the transcription rate is so slow. Right? So that's the largest. The smallest makes small peptides. There aren't any average rules about what genes look like. And in this case, you remember, I said, not only, I haven't mentioned, so for those of you who don't know, of course the protein is collinear with the exons. Right? So how do you get rid of the introns when you transcribe the whole thing? You get rid of it by splicing. Right, so it's just like a movie film. You may keep running it, or just like this lecture, you may keep running it on the web, but we desperately need an editor to cut out the parts that are ridiculous, right? I mean, so that's exactly what's happening, right? And this is the first reading frame, so it splices together these three, right, in the messenger RNA. And then this, occasionally you see something really peculiar, it's an unusual thing. You see that there's an extra exon out here that's used, right? And it splices in, but it doesn't splice in right at the ATG spot where you think. It splices in the middle, and it uses a different reading frame. And reading frame, remember, is interpreted, I read in the order, ATG. So the reading frame might start out TGX, XXX, and so forth, right? And so it's possible to be using information in a duplicate fashion, right? And that, of course, is very powerful, except that a single mutation then annoys two genes, right? Yeah.
I've never understood how this splicing works. I mean, I get the picture.
Yes.
But of course, there's not you sitting in the cell.
That's correct.
Taking.
So there's a structure. It's a lot like the telomere in the sense that we know there's a structure, right, called the spliceosome, I'll call it, right? That's nice to have a name at least, even though we don't understand it, right? And it reads clues that are in the intron. So as per the suggestion, the introns have regulatory elements. It's very clear that if I delete this intron, I don't splice properly, right? So there are regulatory elements here that tell me when to take this RNA and when to splice it here or when to splice it here. Now, a lot has to do with RNA folding. So the RNA that's made base pairs with itself and makes a structure. And you could imagine, I say imagine because no one's seen this, right, that the structure would go along and then loop out and have a little stem that hybridizes it, and then you would cut it and ligate it, right? And now you've spliced, right? You could imagine that structure plays a big role, but structure doesn't happen in the absence of proteins. So that structure, protein-assisted structure, is giving rise to a three-dimensional structure, which then cleaves, and there are rules. There are base pairs which are recognized as splice junctions and so forth, right? So lots of little rules that the cell has learned and it lives with. Now, even quite remarkably, the simplest thing is this autocatalytic splicing. What do I mean by that? That means in the absence of proteins, the RNA folds. It brings together two joints. They're very reactive, and they react with each other and split out, right? So that, you know that structure, right? And it's just like you have imagined. And so there are autocatalytic splicing rules that probably were the first kind of splices, right? And that's the first time we learned that RNA was catalytic. It's not only that proteins have catalysis, the structure, proper structured RNA has catalysis, right? And that's very dangerous because that means it's going to change itself, right? It's going to react in various ways. It's no way to store information when you're reacting like that, right? And that's the reason why we've switched from an RNA world to DNA as the sort of basic information that's preserved, okay?
That tells me that roughly there we have some idea of how splicing works, but it's far from.
Oh yeah. So we have a lot. There's people. There are dozens of people who work on splicing. They publish thousands of papers, which I refuse to read because short-term memory would be used up so badly. I wouldn't be able to give you this lecture, right? I choose to ignore. I mean, if I was a really good splicing guy, I could now write out 15 rules, you know, and tell you a lot about the reactions and stuff like that. But we have to choose what we decide to store in our limited brains. Yeah. And I choose not to. But the good news is you can learn it. That's really good news, yes. That's right. It is good news, yes. And then you can give us a lecture by the end of next week.
So I'll stay with me. Yeah,
so the reason why sequencing. So remember why we want to do sequencing. We can do sequencing now at very high volumes. A very tremendous amount of information can come in, right? And the price is going way down. and even the democratization of sequencing is going way up. By that I mean the following. Used to be, cost $800,000 to buy a sequencing machine, cost $50,000 to $100,000 to sequence a genome. So how many labs could afford those kinds of things? And so what happened was there were genome centers, right? There's one in Beijing that the Chinese government sets up. There's one in Japan. There's five in the United States. There are a couple in Europe. And these genome centers are very well funded, and they grind out most of the information. But it's not very, this is roughly akin to having one accelerator, right? It really was a lack of democratization. Right? And of course, like an accelerator, there are people, there are physicists associated with the genome centers, and they get first crack at the data, right? Now, fortunately, they're not usually overwhelmingly clever, and they then publish the data. Oh, I shouldn't say this in public, right? They publish the data, and what then it becomes democratized. Then everybody can look at it and actually go in and learn new things, right? So this is a place in which there's a lot of reason for physicists to look at these data. First of all, there are a lot of imperfections in the data. There's a high error rate in sequencing. That's the first problem. And they're classical. There are two kinds of error rates. There's stochastic error rates, which are good because you can just by looking at the same gene 100 times, you could work out the stochastic problems. But then there are machine-determined errors, which your algorithms have to smooth out. Right? So this isn't the simple task of just saying, oh, here's the sequence, here's the mutation. Right? And then there are different classes of mutations. So there are some mutations which change the DNA sequence, but not the protein sequence. Those are called synonymous mutations, right? For obvious reasons. And we don't think they're overly important. They may be in splicing, actually. They may be in structure. But we don't think they're overly important to the protein, right? So we don't count synonymous mutations. Then there are non-synonymous mutations, which, of course, change the amino acid. But then there are disastrous mutations. So one of these stop codons appears in the middle of the gene, and now you don't make the protein, it stops. Now that's a killer, right? That protein is non-functional, and it stops. Then there's frame shift mutations. That means instead of reading in the right frame, you've deleted one base, and you're now out of frame, and you're running to a stop codon again. So that's a disastrous mutation. So we have different classes of mutations which we can be sure of some and not of others. And interpreting these is, makes this whole thing an art, essentially, or a little bit of a guessing game in that sense. Right. Yes?
Can I ask a pretty stupid question?
Of course.
How different is the number of genes from person to person? I mean, just 25,000?
About the same. So you have what are called copy number variations, right? And they are exactly what you think they are. Your parents had them, and then sometimes they spontaneously arise. About 1 in 100 births, a copy, or 1 in 50 births, a copy number variation arises spontaneously. What is that? That means a duplication in one strand or a deletion in the other, right? You know how that arises. You know how that arises. I taught you that in the last lecture, right? By unequal crossing over and recombination. That's because you have these ends that come in and invade, right? So this is in fact happening in the germline, and we all differ in some areas by copy number variation. Now, sometimes it's a disaster. You can't live with it. In fact, it's thought that copy number variations are part of the cause of autism. So it's very well known that families that have autistic children, more than one autistic child, which is a tip-off that they have a set of genetic predispositions, they have higher rates of copy number variations than the average population. So the average population may have 3 copy number variations per 100, per 100 births, right? And they have 7 per 100 births. So their genome is less stable, right? And this brings up the concept of genomic instability, right? Rearrangements of the genome. That was the M2 I talked about the other day. Telomere erosion causes genomic instability. Copy number variations, genomic instability, right? And when these things arise, high copy number variation is seen in cancer all the time.
So what is high and what is low?
7 and 3. That's for the autistic families.
7 per 100.
No, 7 different places where there are deletions
In the whole genome?
Well, in your genome, you have about maybe 40 or 50 copy number variations that you've inherited from your parents, even if I don't count the de novo ones, right?
So that's out of 25,000.
That's right. That's right, yeah. And most of the time, a copy number variation doesn't seem to, many times, it doesn't seem to have great disastrous effects on the organism, right? It might make them peculiar, right? Well, there's some autistic kids who you would say are unusual in their social interactions, but they're functional. Right? So the degree to which the phenotype shows up is very variable. But having said that, there are other places where copy number variations have just disastrous effects and no child is born, right? Yeah.
I just want to make sure that I understood correctly. I thought you were going to say that there are gene duplications that cause, that are associated with the disease. But you're actually saying something different. You're saying that duplication rate is different in those families, right? The copy variation.
If the rate is higher, there's a higher probability that the right genes will be hit, right? And so it's still stochastic. The families have normal children and they have autistic children. But the if you have an autistic child, the probability you're going to have a second is higher than if you didn't, right? And if two autistic kids marry and have children, then in fact all the kids are autistic. All the offspring. That's pretty rare.
So that could just be because that particular family has...
Oh, no, that's probably inherited. That's inherited, not spontaneous. That's right. No. Once you have a deletion that is the cause of autism, not, I don't want to imply that one deletion is the cause, but once you have a deletion that triggered the autism, right, there's a high probability that the whole linear descent will have that, right? But the rate at which they occur is higher in that lineage, right?
So I have a question, honey, about what is the rate-limiting step in the cell? It must be something. It's ribosomes, right? It's how many ribosomes you have. So copy numbers shouldn't affect cellular dynamics as much as you might.
Could you get compensation? What you're asking?
Yeah.
So the rate, I would say, the rate-limiting step, as long as ribosomes are almost always in excess. The cell wants ribosomes in excess. What it wants to be rate limiting is the amount of messenger RNA. If you have two copies of a gene, you get twice as much messenger RNA, and you can see that, right? So this is this famous question about X and activation. There are some people in this room that have two X chromosomes and others that have XYs. Well, that is a copy number variation that's significant. But the females are shutting down one of the X's to compensate for the copy number variation, right? X inactivation. That's an epigenetic inactivation. So people who have Li Framini that we talked about, P53 mutations that knock out the gene, right, have half the concentration of message, half the concentration of protein. Because the half-life stays the same, 6 minutes. Right? The half-life of the protein stays the same. And it's making less message. So there are many places, many genes in which twofold amounts are important. Right. There are many places where 30% amounts are important. Yeah. Okay, so we said out of these 25,000 genes, now I'm going to give you some numbers that a fellow named Stratton has put forth. Who's Stratton? Well, he runs one of these very large genome centers. He runs the Wellcome Trust Genome Center in Cambridge, England. Stratton has just published a paper. You could see it. You just Google it and you'll get it. Stratton has just published a paper where he sequenced the exons and the whole genomes of 100 breast cancers. Why is this interesting? Remember, I said, hey, all these genes that cause cancer, they're trapped in viruses. We found them from viruses. We found them from epidemiology, right? We did not do a systematic search for these genes that cause cancer. We took what we got, right? If you wanted to do a systematic search, you'd do exactly what Stratton has done. But we had no capability until recently. Sequence 100 breast cancers and ask the question, what do they look like? How many mutations do they really have? What genes are they really in? Yes?
I was wondering, when you are sequencing exons, how important is the protein isoforms? Because you can have similar exons.
Yeah. So there are many ways to sequence. One is to sequence the DNA. And the way I would sequence exons here is I'd set my primers here and here, right? So that's one strand direction, the other strand direction, and then do a reaction called polymerase chain reaction, which is copying from the primer. Remember, you need a primer to start a DNA. That's why I have primers. And I would then have this piece of DNA, and I've amplified it so I'd have it 100 times, right? I could sequence it 100 times, and then I could ask the question, what are the stochastic mutations, what are the real mutations that I see all the time, right? So that would be exon sequencing, and I could do, there are ways to set primers so I could do all exons of the genome. What was your...
I was wondering, you can have all the exons, but similar exons can actually code...
Yes. So one of the things that's... The reason splicing is so interesting is that one gene can give rise to 10 messages, and 10 messages give rise to 10 different proteins that are subsets of the gene, right? And that they are all functional. And the reason they're functional is that proteins often come in domain structures. They have structural elements that fold, the proteins folding. Protein folding has been a typical place where physical scientists have started to try to figure out, if I know the primary sequence of amino acids, how does it fold? They've all failed at this, pretty much. Right? So they actually try to figure out how to fold it. And you can fold proteins, or proteins are folded, into structural domains. That's units of structure. And they are often units of function. So proteins can do 5 different functions. Right? Remember, the T antigen from SV40 bound RB and bound P53. Those are 2 different domains where it binds. Right? 2 different functions. Right? So it's pretty useful to, instead of sequence DNA, sequence RNA. And now I can get all the isoforms you're talking about from the same gene, and I sequence them and I get the complexities. That is an order of magnitude more complex in deducing the sequence, right? And you have to hope that the primers you're using include the different kinds of splice forms, right?
How important is for cancer? I mean,
that's a hard question. How important? I bet it's going to be important, but I don't know that we have proven it by a long shot. Yeah.
Before even comparing different type of cancers, how do you tackle the heterogeneity of each tumor? How do you know you're comparing?
I'm going to talk about that. Okay. I don't tackle it. It's a problem. I'm just amazed by it. Right. But that's exactly where I'm going with this review. Right. Is where you've just taken me. So let me go there. All right. So we said there are 25,000 genes in the genome. What Stratton would say, what he says in this paper, is about 450 of these genes fall into 3 categories, or 2 categories, that I talked about before. Right? There are about 400 oncogenes. Right? So oncogenes are those genes which suffer mutations. They act in a dominant fashion, the mutation. And the great examples of oncogenes are protein kinases that are constitutively on all the time, signaling for growth, right? Another great example is the amplification, and mutation would be the amplification of cyclin D, or the amplification of the transcription factor MYC, both throw the cell into cell cycle, right? Okay, so those are great examples of oncogenes. They're dominant effectors. Gene amplifications are dominant over the missing genes, right, which are recessive.
Are they the same chromosome on the different?
No, they're all over the place. Although Mickey, who I don't think is here this morning, wanted to give a talk next week to show that some of the tumor suppressor genes are clustered. But no, but they are literally all over the chromosomes, and you can see amplifications on many chromosomes and duplications of chromosomes and things. There are about 50 tumor suppressors, and remember, these act in a recessive fashion. If you have a mutation in one gene, it does no phenotype. You have to have a mutation in both alleles, both genes, from 2 chromosomes, right? Okay. So tumor suppressor genes, remember, are inherited. They're inherited in the heterozygous state, and they predispose people to cancer. Right. So this is roughly the number. And then there are about 250 DNA repair genes. Now, that doesn't count the 450, right? Remember I said that ATM is a DNA repair gene. It sees the breaks in the end of the telomeres. It sees breaks in DNA. It starts a DNA repair process. DNA repair genes don't cause the cancer, but they raise the mutation rate when you have a defective DNA repair gene. And they contribute to genomic instability, all of which contributes to a higher set of mutations in this category, right? So these are causal on the mutation rate, the DNA repair genes. So people inherit DNA repair defects, and they develop cancer at a high rate because the genomic instability is high.
Okay. Yeah. If you get a spontaneous mutation on one tumor suppressor, which is spontaneous, and you have a gene conversion, you should observe this ratio of 1 over 10,000 that you mentioned for retinoblastoma. Then are there other cases that you can see 1 over 10,000 incidents in the population and are due to a spontaneous mutation?
So, for whatever reason, maybe the rates vary and there isn't such a fixed number as 10 to minus 8th and 10 to minus 4th, which is what I gave him. He wanted a number, so I gave him a number, right? So, for instance, retinoblastoma is about 1 in 10,000. There are some that are 1 in 2,000 births. There are some in 1 in 20,000 births. So there isn't a fixed number, and that might mean that gene conversion occurs at different rates at different regions. Why? Because of GC content or repetitive elements or large number of other complexities. That's the structure of the DNA. Actually, it's actual topology of the DNA contributing to the rate at which you get gene conversion, right? Of 1 into 2, yeah. Yes,
not good. Well, one to this conversion, I remember that if you're at the end of the DNA, your chance is higher for
much higher, right.
But my actual question was, if you're only sequencing the exons, of course you would miss, for example, an effect like you told us yesterday, where you just have a somehow a much more active,
So 5' to the gene, or sometime in the first intron. The MDM2 gene has its enhancer element in the first intron. An enhancer element is a place where transcription factors bind. They recognize DNA sequences, right? If you wanted to make 10 times more MYC, right, which would cause a cancer, right? You could get a single mutation in an intron, or 5' to the gene, right? In the promoter region, and MYC, the MYC gene, right, would be made tenfold higher. You'd miss all the regulatory mutations, right? So that is harkens back to the very question that was asked, wouldn't it be smart to do genome, whole genome sequencing, not exon sequencing, because we could see the regulatory mutations? The answer is yes, but could we recognize what a regulatory mutation is the question mark, right? We could say, this is a region which I'll bet is a regulatory mutation, but the way we prove it is we remake that mutation in a mouse or in a cell, and we see that it transcribes at higher rates, right? So every mutation has to be reproduced in some way to demonstrate its phenotype. And even then, it doesn't mean that it works exactly that way in the chromosomes that it's in humans. So it's kind of tough to prove these regulatory mutations. You can suspect them, you can hypothesize them, you can prove them at some points, especially if they're repetitive. That is to say, if a regulatory mutation has occurred in 100 tumors, well, you can say, gee, you know, that isn't by chance. Right?
Confused about the origin of these numbers.
Yeah.
These hits from some association study or studies?
They're the consequence of about 35 years of research, and they come from, remember, some oncogenes are trapped in viruses and then they cause cancer. By the way, this is not a laboratory artifact. Kittens, if one kitten gets leukemia, the entire litter will get leukemia. In cats, leukemia is an infectious disease. Why? Because they have a retrovirus. And the retrovirus carries an oncogene, it's called feline leukemia, the oncogene. It's called FES, feline leukemia oncogene, right? And that oncogene spreads by retrovirus infections, and of course in a kitten litter, they're all together and they all spread, and the entire litter comes down with leukemia, right? Remember, Peyton Rouse's farmer came to him and said, hey, my chickens have all got this tumor, right? That's an infectious agent in birds causing cancer, right? But that doesn't happen in humans. We're not quite sure why. Retroviruses that carry oncogenes have never been found in humans. I'm going to talk about viruses in a few minutes, but to get back to the human viruses. But in animals, many kinds of cancers are infectious diseases because they carry these oncogenes. They carry one of these oncogenes that triggers a whole set of things.
So
given that the numbers come from the time interval of knowledge.
They come from knowledge. Yes.
So is there a sense that we're saturating there?
Oh, well, so that's the reason why people do genome sequencing, right? Is to ask the question, have I found new oncogenes and new tumor suppressor genes? And the answer is we are finding new ones, but they're not at an alarmingly high rate. So I think we're at an asymptote, but we haven't saturated, is probably where I'd put it right now. In fact, in neuroendocrine tumors, pancreatic, the kind of tumor Steve Jobs died of, a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. This is a pancreas tumor, which is a tumor of the beta cells that make insulin. Right? It's a very indolent tumor. Most people live 10 years with the tumor. But it's very highly metastatic, goes to the liver, and the liver's destroyed, and then you die. Now, he got a liver transplant that gave him an extra 5 years. So the kind of tumor that Steve Jobs, this is a really, you know enough now to really appreciate this, died of, have two mutations in proteins that bind to telomeres. And what do? They redo the chromatin structure of telomeres. And without them, you have tremendous genomic instability, right? Without them, if you're not assembling the chromatin structure on telomeres properly, the ends are there, and you get tremendous number of genomic changes, right? The kind of, and those are two new oncogenes we knew nothing about, right? And they appear in 30-40% of the neuroendocrine tumors, these guys, right? And they're really quite interesting because, let me answer a question you asked yesterday that I sloughed off. I sloughed off because I was a little bit worried that no one here understood recombination. But now that we all understand recombination, we're going to be in better shape, right? So remember what's happening to a chromosome. The ends, the theoretical ends of the chromosome are getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and a catastrophe happens. The telomeres ends expose, and you get a lot of genomic instability, right? To prevent the catastrophe, the ATM protein kinase binds to the telomere as it's just before its catastrophe time. It signals to P53. P53 makes P21. P21 inhibits cyclin E-CDK2. That stops the cell cycle in G1, and the cells no longer divide, and the genomic instability is quiescent. That we call mortality 1, right? It's before you have any trouble. It's avoiding the stress, right? Now, the way around this problem, and the way the cancers usually work, because they could kill themselves, the cancers, by having genomic instability. No one likes genomic instability. Cancers like it a little bit, but not too much, right? It's an error catastrophe threshold, right? So the cancers themselves make telomerase. Telomerase has an RNA, which now copies the DNA back and lengthens the telomeres again, right? And that's the way in which cancers, 90% of cancers have telomerase. So Boris asked yesterday, what about the other 10%? If 90% have it, what are the other 10% doing? Well, they do a very interesting thing, right? They start off with short telomeres. They have many copies of short telomeres. These little lines are the telomere sequences, right? Right. And then, because this is a 6-base pair repeat, right? The base pairing can slide, right? It doesn't have to be lined up. I can take this guy and hybridize it to this guy, right? And I could hybridize it like this, so their base pairs line up, or I can hybridize it like this. Why? Because the repeats are here, right? And if I get unequal crossing over, I've got one chromosome with a long repeat and one with a very short repeat, right? So this unequal crossing over, which is so bad, right? And it regains one chromosome to have a long telomere by recombination, right? And then one cell dies, because it's got a short telomere, and the other cell lives, and it goes through 10 more generations, right? Okay. Now, this is an interesting problem, right? Because this gives us a hypothesis that we can test in the clinic, right? Are the 10, so telomerase is catalytic. Everybody gets long ends. This is not catalytic. It takes exponential growth, geometric growth, and makes it linear. Why? Because only first division, only one cell lives. Then you divide a few times, then only one cell lives. Then you divide a few times, and only one cell lives. This is not exponential growth. So the question is, are those the indolent tumors? Are those the tumors that grow slowly, that are not threatening? Could I predict what's indolent by using the unequal crossing over? Right? And it's these two oncogenes that we discovered by sequencing that Steve Jobs had, right, that in fact are the oncogenes that do this. That in the absence of those guys, you get the alternate read. Right? So about 10% of tumors are not growing logarithmically. And they may be the indolent tumors. And that may be in a, that may be something we want to know, because you wouldn't want to actively treat people who have indolent tumors. Right? That's a way that the data give you a hypothesis that you go back to a clinic to test, because you've got to sequence the tumor, but at the same time, you've got to watch the patient for 10 years. Okay? Questions in or mouth? Yes?
Going back to that paper you're about to talk about, how does it react to epigenetic modifications like methylation?
So I haven't introduced epigenetic modifications. I actually probably will do that a little bit this afternoon and a lot on my Tuesday talk, which is a sort of luncheon talk. I don't know who gets invited to luncheon talks. Is anybody that wants to eat that get invited?
Everybody.
There's no lunch. There's no free lunch.
There's no free lunch.
On lunch. Okay, so I was going to talk about it more then, a little bit. But let me just sort of... No, the sequencing does not give you information about epigenetics. So epigenetic marks are of two kinds. One is on the DNA. Cytosine in the dinucleotide CG is methylated. Heavy methylation of those cytosines turn off the gene. Right? And then it's wrapped, you know more, you guys, several of you work on chromatin structure. The DNA is wrapped around nucleosomes, right? And in wrapping it around nucleosomes, the N-terminal ends of the amino acids, of the four different histones that make up nucleosomes, are modified by different groups. Acetyl group, or almost always on lysines or arginines, acetyl groups, methyl groups. And that's a way to take the DNA and either silence it or activate it for transcription. And so you'd have to, there's two things you have to do, and one we can do. You'd have to look at the methylation patterns in the DNA. We can do that. That's done by sequencing again, but it's a different kind of sequencing because you're looking for methyl C, right? And the other is you'd have to be able to isolate the chromatin from a gene, which we can do by antibodies. Right? And then you'd have to look at that chromatin structure to see what it was, to know about epigenetics. But it's quite clear, the enzymes that make these epigenetic changes in the proteins are amplified, they're oncogenes. Some of them are oncogenes, that's the right way to put it. And they were never trapped in viruses, they were found by different methods. Yeah. Okay? All right, so yeah.
So the process roughly doubles the telomere?
No, it's variable because I can, if I slide, I can. Well, I, sometimes I can get 100, sometimes I get 10.
But on average, like 30%.
I don't know the average.
But and then when you cut off,
I know what you're dragging me to a calculation, and I don't know. I don't want to calculate how many generations the one guy goes through because I don't know. Right.
Let's continue.
The question is, why is it linear versus exponential? It depends how much you multiply versus subtract each step.
Correct.
So to be linear, it has to exactly subtract as much as you multiply. That's why I wasn't sure why you claim linear versus exponential.
It's not linear, it's sub-exponential.
It's sub-exponential, yes. You ask him what sub-exponential means, he brought it up, right? Yeah.
Lunch discussion.
Yeah. It's in the middle between a linear function and an exponential function, right? It's a binomial equation that's in the middle, right?
Okay, we'll talk about it.
1.3 exponent, right? That's the answer. The exponent is not 1, it's not 2, it's between 1 and 2, right? But it varies for different tumors, right? There is no answer that it's this way all the time, right? Nothing in biology is this way all the time, right? That's the problem with the calculations you want to make. Yeah.
I wanted to know if this tissue specificity
specificity.
Thank you. Of cancer, could this be related to the way DNA is packaged? So it's different packaged in different tissues, and therefore some oncogenes are.
But many people believe there's two reasons for the tissue specificity to speculate about it. One is the epigenetic marks that are on that allow it to be expressed or not. Most of these oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes are pretty central to the cell cycle. So for any cells that are dividing, they have to be there, right? And then the second is that they don't work exactly the same way in every cell, right? So a skin cell, it works differently than a blood cell. So that the pathways are different, so that the genes that get mutated are different. And what I'm giving you, if I show you a pathway, is an average pathway that I gleaned from fibroblasts in cell culture rather than gleaned from lymphocytes in the blood, right? So that's part of the problem. Is tissue specificity is obviously an important variable here, but we see different oncogenes in different tissues, in fact. Yeah. Okay, so what did Stratton do, right? He took 100, he had now 450 different genes to look at, and he calls those the primary players, right? Any mutations in those genes, because they've been validated in the literature, they're primary players. But there's mutations are random in these. I mean, the process of generating mutations is generally random. So there are mutations in lots of other genes. And we can't know whether they're being optimized and selected for in the tumor, right? So what we do is we ask the question, what are the essential mutations in this list of 450? What are the other mutations, okay? So he has 100 now, we have 100 breast tumors. And he can list all of these 50 tumor suppressors in 400, right? And then he asks, how many tumors have that, right? Well, the first thing is that of the 100 tumors, the combinatorics that you find together, right, produce 72 different kinds of tumors. That's different by mutation in the, what genes, right? Five of the tumors have none of these guys, right? None might mean one of two things, completely epigenetic, right? Not a genetic change, but completely a change in the way genes are regulated, right? Okay, so that would be completely epigenetic, or this is not a saturated group, and we have more, these tumors have mutations that we don't recognize. Right? But this is an immediate tip-off that 72, that three-quarters of the tumors have different patterns, tells you there isn't a breast cancer. There, genetically, there are many ways to get there. Right? However, there are four or five players, oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes, which come up in more than 50% of the time in these tumors. Right? The highest is P53. Right. Then there's a gene called PI3 kinase. This is part of the insulin-like growth factor pathway that we'll actually get into next. Right? This is a metabolic regulator of glucose. Right? So here we have a stress responder and a metabolic regulator of glucose, MYC. MYC is the gene that's like E2F. Right? It's turning on a growth phenotype. It transcribes thousands of these 25,000 genes that are needed for cell division. It's a big switch in cell division. So it is the guy that gears up, right? It also allows, while PI3 kinase allows for glucose use, nutrient use, MYC allows for glutamine use. Glutamine is an amino acid that supplies nitrogen sources to the cell. And it also, as you'll see, when I talk about metabolism, it also is a really interesting alternate to glucose. It's really quite amazing what happened in life. Every organism from bacteria through humans has chosen to use glucose as their major source of nutrient, right? So the consistent throughout all of evolution, once it got started, it's been kept, right? glucose, it could have been any sugar if you think about it, but glucose is a nice sugar, 6-carbon sugar, and glucose is also, everything's converted to glucose, right, that we utilize. Right? And the pathways to metabolize glucose, so the glucose has 6 carbons, as you break each carbon you generate energy, that energy is turned into ATP, ATP is the source of energy the cell uses, right? And for 1 mole of glucose, you get about 36 moles of ATP, right? By these processes. And everybody from bacteria through humans uses those processes, with one exception. The bacteria use the first part of the pathway called glycolysis, and higher eukaryotes use the second part of the pathway, glycolysis plus oxidative phosphorylation. Right? And there's actually good reason to believe that the oxidative phosphorylation was acquired by a bacteria that parasitized the evolutionary tree that we're on. Right? So that the origins of mitochondria, in which oxidative phosphorylation occur, are origins that are very bacterial-like. We can talk a little bit about that if you want to talk about the evolution of this. But nonetheless, here are the two great nutrient regulators in humans. And mammals, right, and vertebrates, right at the top of this list, along with the stress, right? BCL2, right? This is an anti-apoptotic regulator. Now, remember what we got very early on, we got into the question of what regulates growth. And I said, oh, it's regulating growth is not just division. It's the lack, if you want to get growth, it's the lack of death. So it's division minus death, right, is the rate of growth. And I even said that in the absence of a growth factor, in the absence of a maintenance factor, right, death is your default position, right? So death is actually what is programmed into you that you're actively pushing against. And one of the ways to do that is by this molecule BCL2, which stops apoptosis. So what's the tumor strategy? Stop apoptosis, BCL2. Right? Okay. So these four guys, let me see if I'm missing anyone else, if I think of another one, are the most common changes you see in breast cancer.
Arnie, BRAX has been used.
Say again?
BRAX or BRAX,
B-R-A-X.
BAX.
BAX, yeah.
BAX is a downstream regulated with P53.
Okay.
Yeah. So BAX is pro-apoptotic.
BAX or BRAX?
BRCA. Probably
it's about the breast cancer.
Oh, BRCA one. You mean BRCA one? Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, so first of all, let me say, in the tumor suppressor gene class, there are two tumor suppressor genes: BRCA1 and BRCA2. That's called breast cancer tumor suppressor gene 1 and 2. Right. These are tumor suppressor genes. So people who inherit BRCA1 and BRCA2 in heterozygous state, right, will develop breast cancer sometime over their lifetime. Probability is between 60% and 80%, depending upon the genetic background of the person. 1 in 10 breast cancers in Ashkenazi Jews are in fact BRCA1. But it's 1 in 100 breast cancers, or 1 in 1,000 breast cancers in the population in general. Right? So that just means the Ashkenazi Jews were a very highly inbred population for several hundred years in Eastern Europe. And that inbred breeding raised the frequency of BRCA1 and BRCA2. Right? But those are not, so they're whole classes of BRCA tumors, but those do not contribute spontaneously. This is spontaneous mutations. I should say, when you sequence, it's very interesting. When you sequence a person, you don't only sequence the tumor. You sequence the blood. And you're sequencing the blood to subtract the genetic background that you got. And there you see BRCA1, then you would have inherited. But if you ask how many times spontaneously this occurs, it's practically not at all in breast cancers, and it's 30% in ovarian cancers. So it does occur spontaneously, but it's ovarian cancers. By the way, if I was to just list, they just finished, this is breast. If I was to list ovarian, it would be P53 and BRCA 1 and 2 would be in this high list, right? So ovarian gives a different list than breast, that gives a different list than pancreas, right? Gives a different list, right? So this tells you tissue specificity is pretty interesting, which we come back to again.
Yeah. How did Stratton know that these were spontaneous and not
because he sequenced the blood of these people, and so he had a presumably germline derivative that was not the tumor, and then he sequenced the tumor, and he just compared them, right? So he knows spontaneous from the background.
Can you said this is the most open ones. Can you just give an order of magnitude? P53 is like 80% or?
50 to 60%, 35%, 30%, 20% cutoff, right?
Thanks.
And then, actually, of the 72 others, there are singlets, there are, you know, all the other things we've learned, right, about. Yes?
As metabolism is so important, how important are, for example, mitochondria or sequencing the DNA of mitochondria?
Some people say that mitochondrial DNA mutations contribute to cancer. You're going to see in a few minutes, if we have probably this afternoon now, you're going to see before you metabolize your lunch, right? The mitochondria are largely shut down in cancer cells. The oxidative phosphorylation, which goes on in the mitochondria, is not utilized heavily. That most cancer cells use what's called the Warburg effect, which means they're using glycolysis very heavily. It's called aerobic glycolysis because it occurs with oxygen. They're using glycolysis very heavily, generating pyruvate. So they're only breaking one carbon. They go from six carbons to three carbons. The pyruvate is reduced to lactate. The lactate is secreted. And that's what causes this acid environment around the tumor, right? But normally a cell, right now, or if you went out for a run, you would immediately take that pyruvate, convert it to acetyl-CoA, a 2-carbon, gain some ATP, and run that 2-carbon around the TCA cycle in the mitochondria and generate another 30 ATPs, right? You would burn it to carbon dioxide and water instead of burning it to lactose, right? So what does it mean? Yeast ferment. They don't burn it all the way to carbon dioxide and water. They give you alcohol. That's wine, right? They give you butyric acid so you can make butter, right? If you ferment the cream of milk, right? All these bacteria and the yeast are stopping and utilizing these intermediates, right? And to give the answer to why on earth, the reason this was discovered, actually, it's quite an interesting story because it's really true of all sciences, right? So a guy named Otto Warburg in Germany discovered this in the 1920s. He said, cancer cells are burning glucose at a very high rate, running it through the glycolytic pathway and making lactate, right? And that makes like 2 or 3 ATPs instead of 30, right? And so people said, what the hell? I mean, this is cancer cells grow like hell. They're efficient. Why? This doesn't make any sense, right? So Warburg announced that this was the answer to cancer, right? And everyone said, he's crazy. And he was roundly ignored until about 10 years ago when he was reconfirmed. And people said, what's going on here, right? And in fact, what you do by not burning it to carbon dioxide and water, glucose, is you save carbons for intermediates that synthesize membranes, that synthesize ribosomes, that synthesize nucleotides, that synthesize amino acids, and make the cell grow, right? Now, you do this many times normally. The embryo does this. Why? Because the embryo grows like hell. The immune system does this. Why? Because the immune system responds to infectious diseases very, very rapidly through cell division, right? Immune system amplifies through cell division. Wound healing does this, right? When you cut yourself and you're healing the wound, it's a Warburg effect. You're just using glucose like hell to patch this up very fast in replication, and cancer does this. So it's a strategy to generate intermediates. And so not only is cancer a disease that is of growth, its whole metabolic profile has changed, right? And you can see that nowhere in the world, right? There's one other gene. Oh. I'll think of in a minute. There's one other gene plus MYC which turn on the whole glycolytic pathway. It's called HIF-1-alpha, right? It's a hypoxia gene.
The Warburg effect is a necessity more than a strategy, because
it's a necessity to make the right intermediates to grow.
Well,
right?
They operate many times in anoxic conditions, and therefore they have to do this.
Sometimes they are anoxic, and sometimes they are pretty good oxygenators, right? But HIF-1-alpha is for the anoxic conditions. This is HIF-1-alpha is a transcription factor, like MYC is. It turns on the glycolytic genes, all of that pathway that makes glucose to pyruvate, right? Transcribes them, and you get a 100-fold increase in glycolytic genes, right? It's a complete change in metabolic pathway. Now that's important. It's a shame it took 60 years to remember that it was important, but that's important because it's another strategy to attack the cancer. Okay? All right. So what's the take-home message here, right? Tremendous heterogeneity in the origins of cancer based on the sequencing. Yes.
So, does one think that there were gene conversions also happening? I mean, so
gene conversion.
Should I think of these mutations as happening on one of the chromosomes and then the other one?
So where there are tumor suppressors, they have to be knocked out of both, mm-hmm. or usually are, and where there are oncogenes, they don't. Okay. Right. So there's some gene conversion happening as well. When the tumor suppresses. So for P53, the most common route is through the reduction of homozygosity through gene conversion. So you can figure out that there's a rather active gene conversion going on, but it doesn't have to be too active. I mean, as soon as you get a tumor that's grown up, even in the absence of the second P53 mutation, you now got lots of cells. You got 10 to the 8th cells, 10 to the 9th cells. If it happened in a rare clone, then it would grow out, right? And that brings up the second point here. This sequence, this DNA sequence, is an average sequence across 10 to the 9th cells. You could very well want to ask the question, suppose I chose one cell here, one cell here, one cell here, what would the sequence be? And how heterogeneous is this tumor, right? And that has been done only a few times. That has been done twice or three times. But the answer is becoming clear, the tumor's heterogeneous as well, right?
Arnie, in colorectal cancer, yeah. You need to have these key mutations happen in a particular sequence.
Yes.
Is that the case here too? Is there a hierarchy between, or a sequence between these four genes?
The reason you can test that in colorectal cancer is because you can get tissue material from different stages of the cancer. You don't usually get tissue material from different stages of breast cancer. You could compare a grade 1 to a grade 3 from two different women, but remember, there are no two women that are alike. There's 72 different kinds of tumors. So the comparison isn't a good one.
So they are not necessarily associated with sequence of clonal dimensions.
No. Let me say one other word about breast cancer that gives a little bit more satisfying answer than this. But first of all, this says, hey, this has not found all of the genes so far, but it's found a lot of them, right? Secondly, it says tremendous heterogeneity between tumors, tremendous heterogeneity within tumors. That's real problems for the strategies of how to treat tumors. That's big problems, right? And there's no reason to believe that this is the only heterogeneous kind of cancer. There's probably all cancers are. Yes, Boris.
So somewhat related question, just looking at this list, like, we believe that each malignant cell, right, has to have, let's say, four mutations at least, right?
Oh, so yeah.
And of course, the probability, right, with the right, those frequencies, the probability that any cell has those four is pretty small. So should I be thinking of this as nailing the four pathways that have to be knocked out, and then sort of thinking that some cell will have P53, but will not have PI3K, but perhaps it will have something else in the insulin signaling pathway? And to what extent is it possible to go down this list into sort of less frequent genes? Maybe to rephrase this, suppose
I'm listening.
You are lumping the So probably the frequencies, right, the probabilities, not on particular genes, but on pathways.
Yeah.
Right, and you asked how frequently you have something in the
so we're going to delve into pathways next, but let me just give you, you've had one pathway. You know the cell cycle pathway. You know that cyclin D, CDK4, leads to cyclin E, transcribes, results in the transcription of cyclin E, which leads to the transcription of cyclin A, which leads to, right? So those are pathways. They're linear, in this case, simple linear pathways with go gates that tell one to give rise to the next, to the next. Blocking any one of them has been sufficient to stop the whole cycle, right? All of these genes, these 50 tumor suppressors and 400 oncogenes, have been assembled into pathways. Into pathways that do things. Now, probably the single most interesting fact about these pathways is one that's not very often stressed, and that is almost all of the 400 and all of the tumor suppressor genes play a strong role in development of the organism. They are essential for the development of a colon and a gut. They are essential for the development of a breast. They are essential for the development of all organs, right? The brain, and so forth. Right? So these are developmental genes that are important in making the organism, being reused in abnormal ways to contribute to the abnormal disease cancer. Right? And we'll talk about, and that's even true about the metabolic regulatory genes. Right? So what Boris has said is true. Right? So if I ask the question, what's the average number of key mutations? What are key mutations, either in the 400 or the 50? Right? There are 4 to 5 key mutations in every tumor. Right? More than that, they are never in the same pathway. They are in 4 or 5 different pathways. And that was Boris's comment. Aha! We're perturbing not one pathway, developmental pathway and growth pathway. We're perturbing 4 or 5. That one is probably not sufficient to give rise to cancer, except in a rare case, but all 4 or 5 are absolutely required. Still inhibiting one is sufficient to stop the cancer, but one is not sufficient to cause the cancer, right? So that's the first conclusion that Boris made. They're in different pathways, there are 4 or 5 key mutations. If I exon sequence and I ask how many mutations are there in all exons, the number varies between 6,000 and 17,000, right? That means the mutation rate has been elevated in the cancer cell. That's not the rate at which you see mutations in blood cells, right? So there's genomic instability in many cancer cells, and there's a tremendous mutation rate, and it's driving the cancer, right? Remember, P53, every time it sees DNA damage or stress that causes mutations, kills. In the absence of P53, no killing, genomic instability. Right? Now if I do whole genome sequencing instead of exon sequencing, to get at the question you've asked, instead of 6,000 to 17,000, I find 60,000 to 180,000 mutations. Right? They're all over the place. But now I'm a deluge. I don't know what's important. I'll never know what's important. I am not doing 180,000 experiments to test every one of those mutations, right? So I'll never know whether they're important unless they occur over and over and over again. Yeah?
Do they actually have DNA repair mutations?
What?
How frequent do you find DNA repair mutations, given that you have so many mutations across?
You do find DNA repair mutations. Yeah. You can find DNA repair.
What fraction in this study?
I don't know that actually. I really you could look it up. It's published now, but I don't know that. Yes, sir.
So how should we think about the tumor? Does it start from a single cell and then continues on? And
yes.
So each individual tumor has one parent cell.
That's probably right. Yeah.
And then do we know how many or how far apart are the offspring?
Yeah. So you could, by knowing the sequence, extrapolate back. Suppose I took the tumor and divided it into 10 parts, and then I found heterogeneity, and then I would extrapolate back from the heterogeneity and say, this is the common first mutation. This is the common second mutation. So I could reconstruct the order from the parts, right? And people are trying to do that. It just is harder and harder to do single cell. Ultimately, you'd like to do single cell variation, but you can bisect the tumor into many parts. Right? you'll see on Friday, I'm sort of staying away from colon cancer, you'll see on Friday that there are some cancers that lend themselves particularly to this question you're asking. Colon cancer is one. Why? Because it starts with a benign polyp, and colonoscopy can extract that polyp. So I can ask the question, what's in the start, right? It's very likely that it started with a single clone of cells. I'll give you a very good example of how I know it starts with a single clone. If I take one of these viruses that causes cancer and I put it into an animal, the entire tumor has the virus with the identical integration site. That integration is random, right? That tells you that it started with a single event, the integration and the expression, and that event is preserved forever, right? So the best evidence I have that tumors are clonal comes from marking them in some way like that.
But then that's the Q45 mutation, and the other is the 60,000 IL.
Yeah, so the presumption is, the presumption is that one of the Q45 mutations started it, but that's a presumption because, you know, no one was there to watch, right? We do know, though, you could do it a different way, that if you inherit a P53 mutation, you're going to get tumors, right? And that, you know, started with a mutation, right? Because you inherited it. But that's a little unfair because you get different tumors that way than you do from spontaneous. Yes.
Also, is it reasonable to think that even if you get only some of the mutations, cell can get some cancers, but it can gain slight selective advantage
yes.
for a long time?
Yes.
Slowly.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me give you an example of experiments that have been done. There's a disease called Barrett's esophagus, right? What happens is that if you drink too much, for example, this is a good moral lesson, right? If you drink too much, you get acid in your stomach, too much coffee or too much alcohol, get acid in your stomach and it fluxes up and it bathes your esophagus. And if that happens a lot, now your esophagus is being killed by the acid. And so it does the normal thing, it regenerates, and then it's killed, and then it regenerates, and it's killed, and it's regenerated, right? Now I've set up an inflammatory reaction where I'm getting life and death, life and death, life and death, and I've raised the mutation rate. You get many more mutations with actively dividing cells than you do with cells progressing through the cycle, right? So you will now have a predisposition to esophageal cancer. You go to a doctor, he says, here's the medicine, we got to stop this acid, we got to stop this stuff, right? You have a predisposition. And if you go to a medical school doctor, he will say, can I biopsy your esophagus? Can I go in and take a little bit of your esophagus? I'm going to take, you know, all the spots that look like shit, right? And I'm going to just, you know, look at them under the microscope and everything, right? And then I'm going to sequence the DNA, right? And then you'll see P53 mutations. And then you'll see other mutations. It's not cancer. It's a predisposition to cancer. But these mutations have started to accumulate, right? And that tells you that's a particular accessible, known situation. It's like the colon cancer situation, where you have a colonoscopy and then you see a polyp, right? It's a situation where I can get the early stages. And you'll see many of these mutations, but they're not sufficient. And we'd call it precancerous or benign tumors or things like that. Many women, as they get older, have P16 mutations in breast tumors. So in breast tissue, sorry. So reduction mammograms, right? So women who want to reduce the size of their breasts, their tissue is taken out, and that's donated for sequencing, and you see P16 mutations. Right? And so here, P16 mutations are down here, somewhere about 12%, right? Cyclin D mutations are in here at about 13%. A phosphatase called RIP1 mutation is about 13%, right? RIP1 is in fact a P53 regulated gene. So you know, there are different classes of breast cancers, but they're in the 10%ers, right? Now, while the genetics tells you there's tremendous heterogeneity, there's a second approach to breast cancer classification which tells you there's less heterogeneity, right? And so let's just take that because we've got a really good example on the table here. And that's looking at messenger RNA patterns, right? And here I can look at splices, right? for the first time. So I'm going to look at the messenger RNA patterns. Now, traditionally, the way this, you can do this by something called RNA-seq. Right? I take RNA out of the breast tumor, I make DNA copies, and then I sequence the DNA, and I'm getting copies of all the RNAs in the cell. Right? But traditionally, though, it's done in a slightly different way. You use a chip. So there's a chip, and on the chip is an oligonucleotide that is 25 to 100 nucleotides long. And if I take the RNA from breast cancer and I hybridize it to that, each oligonucleotide represents a different exon. So I can get all the exons in the cell, I can look at all the messenger RNAs, and I can get the concentration of the messenger RNAs and their presence on the chip. Now I do that by labeling the DNA I make as copies of RNA with a fluorescent probe, and I read the intensity of fluorescence. This is your experiment that you described yesterday, but you can't do it in cells, you do it on a chip, right? So I'm reading fluorescence intensity. The RNA-DNA interaction is a second-order rate constant. It depends on time and concentration. So the concentration gives me roughly the level of the messenger RNA at steady state in the cell, right? Now, when I do that, I get a load of fluorescent data, right, which I now have to decode and say what genes are being expressed and at what levels. Right? Now, I have normal breast tissue and I have cancer breast tissue. Right? So I'm going to classify for you five or six different classes of messenger RNA patterns in breast cancer that have been seen. The first pattern, that's breast tumors, is called normal. Right? Why? Because it's very close to normal. Maybe those are the five tumors that were here. Right? There's one called luminal A and one called luminal B. Right? These luminal, this breast tissue, what the function of breast tissue is to make milk and secrete it. So breast tissue has an epithelial layer and a lot of fat around it, epithelial layer. And then the epithelial layer manufactures milk and secretes it into the lumen. And the lumen carries the milk to the nipple. Right? And so that is the structure. And luminal A and luminal B are luminal tumors, tumors of those cells. Right? Okay. Then there's a tumor it's called basal. Right? Why? Because it's at the base of that tube. It's at the base of the tube that's making milk, and it's called basal. Right? And then there's what you've asked about, BRCA 1 and BRCA 2, and then there is the epidermal growth factor receptor, right? Remember I said, oh, these receptors and their growth factors are oncogenes. That happens to be called HER2 new, and it's the EGF receptor. There are five EGFs. It's one of the five. It's the number two, her regulin receptor, right? Okay, so I now can classify by RNA patterns. Each of these is different from each other, and I get classification, right? Now you'd love to ask the question, what are the mutations that drive this, right? This is estrogen positive, progesterone positive. This is progesterone positive, right? So estrogen is a receptor that sees a hormone you make, it engages, it moves to the nucleus, and it transcribes a set of genes. And in this case, the breast expands, estrogen-driven. Progesterone, breast expands. Right? Progesterone receptor positive. This is called triple negative. Why is it triple negative? Because it's HER2 new negative, progesterone negative, and estrogen negative. Triple negative. So now we start to have various physiological properties, right? Here, right? All the P53 mutations are here, here, and here. Right? So of the 50% to 60% P53 mutations, they're all in a subclass, and now most basal cell tumors have P53 mutations. This is really a beautiful example of in vivo of what I've said stress is about, right? BRCA1 and BRCA2 are DNA repair proteins. They repair single and double-stranded breaks in the DNA. The absence of BRCA1 and BRCA2 leave single and double strands breaks in the DNA. Women are born perfectly normal. They have normal breasts. Some women go through 60, 70 years of life without tumors. Why? P53 is watching these breaks and killing cells every time they occur. It is backing up. It is backing up the loss of BRCA1 with death, right? This creates the stress in the genome. This kills the cell, right? So every BRCA1 mutation in BRCA2, every one of them, almost 95%, have P53 mutations. The only way you develop cancer. This is called a second site suppressor. It's suppressing the phenotype, right? And in suppressing the phenotype, right, it's at a different locus, different gene that suppresses the phenotype, right? So when you see P53 mutations, you can bet that there are DNA damaging effects, right? Yeah.
But is BRCA1 and 2 are somehow breast specific? Like,
so that's another one of these enigmatic tissue specificities. So you, for instance, there are many genetic disorders that are important for all tissues. BRCA1, BRCA2 is one of them. You'll see with mismatch repair in the colon, right? Which even though they are in all tissues, they predispose to cancers in some tissues but not others. So BRCA1 and BRCA2 are really ovarian cancer predispositions, but they do breast as well. They are involved in breast tumors as well. So, but they're not very common in any other tumors.
So is there a sense in those tissues are...
You saw some in prostates. Yeah.
Particularly proliferative, you know, obviously there is a lot of...
I don't know. There's no doubt that I don't think breast is more proliferative than, let's say, bone marrow. But breast is not more proliferative than colon, right? There are many proliferative tissues which BRCA1 and BRCA2 may be backed up with something, right? I mean, that's one hypothesis. But this, I hate to make this a theme because there's no answer to it. I wish I even had a good hypothesis for it. But the theme is arising that these mutations act at certain locations, right? And they, even though they're in other cells and they're used for DNA repair, they're not causing the cancer. I would say it's probably because they're backed up, but you don't know. Yeah.
That really seems like a fundamental mystery, right? So.
Well, it is a fundamental mystery, it's a fundamental mystery for which I just try and keep thinking of ideas, but I don't have many.
There are a bunch of papers on it where they say that it regulates the choice between homologous repair and end joining. The BRCA1 is actually watching over these two processes. And if you have 53 BP1 is also involved in this.
Right.
And so it's like a manager that decides. And if you do homologous...
All of that's correct, but it doesn't say exactly why it happens in breast, why it gives rise to breast tumors and not colon tumors, right?
Nobody knows.
Yeah. It's active in the colon. It's managing in the colon. It's managing in the breast, right?
Mitigate that.
It's not that it's not there. It's there. But it doesn't really play a big role, right? So by transcriptional patterns, you can get some order out of this. And the order can say something about mutations and something about the properties of the tumors, but the genetics looks very tough, right?
So it looks like it's convergent. You have this whole broad range of mutations, but they converge on very specific patterns of gene expression.
Yeah. So let's say these are the players, and here's the depressing. There's a pretty depressing news. It gets worse, right? Once you know the reason why cancer has gotten to be a very interesting subject from the point of view of disease processes is that the academic community has transferred to the pharmaceutical industry a long list of targets that are aberrant in cancer cells, and if you can inhibit them, you'll stop the cancer, right? That information has been very valuable. And there are now 600 to 800 new compounds running through clinical trials, which will, some subset of which will hit the market in 5 or 10 years, right? A big subset has already hit the market. There's 20 or 30 of them, right? There's, when we get to the RAS pathway, you'll see there's an oncogene called BRAF. This is a great example. BRAF is in melanomas. It's a protein kinase, BRAF. It's an abnormal protein kinase, and when it's mutated in melanomas, there's a drug that inhibits it, and the melanomas shrink. there has never been a melanoma drug, right? I mean, this is a really remarkable thing. People get melanomas, they get metastatic melanomas, and there's a death sentence. They could do nothing. BRAF makes them shrink, right? Now, resistance to the drug occurs at a very high rate. Why? Because of genomic instability. There's ways around it. Then there's enigmatic observations. Something, I don't know, 10% of colon cancers have BRAF mutations. You say, I'm going to treat those colon cancers with BRAF, right? Drug, I have a drug. It doesn't work. Again, tissue specificity. However, if you ask the question, why doesn't it work? It's because there's an EGF receptor, and if you block the EGF receptor and you treat with BRAF, that works. Right? So we're now starting to figure out the circuitry. That's this pathway issue. The connections between two things that if you inhibit both, you get it to work. Right? That's the really big value of having drugs. So there may be 15, 20 drugs on the market. The first one that came on the market is absolutely phenomenal drug because it's for a chronic disease, not for an acute disease. So there's a disease called chronic myelogenous leukemia. Right? It's a blood disease, leukemia. It's chronic, which means that you'll have it for 5 years or so at very simmering low levels, and then it goes acute and you die. And in the past, the only way to save you was a bone marrow transplant. You just wipe out all your bone marrow and you get a new set of bone marrow and then you make new blood. Right? That was the treatment. It was really awful treatment. Right? The cause of this is a protein kinase called ABL. ABL is a protein kinase that recognizes DNA damage. And it's constantly signaling in the cell, and it's constantly driving the cell to divide. Right? So it's a translocation of a chromosome called BCR-ABL. It's actually, it was first found in Philadelphia when I was a graduate student. It happened just down the hall from me. It's called the Philadelphia chromosome. Right? You see that chromosome, you know ABL is involved. See that translocation. Translocations occur because telomeres erode. Right? This is chronic disease that simmers along. Make an inhibitor to the protein kinase ABL, and the disease disappears. Right? Just live your life. Take one pill a day. One pill a day. Stop the pill, comes back. So it's disappeared, but not 100%. So, but if you take the pill, you're fine. Resistance, maybe 1 to 2% of the patient population each year becomes resistant to the drug. They have a second drug now for the resistance. Right? Chronic myelogenous leukemia is finished, right? Probably the best success. Why? It's chronic. It's low levels. You don't, high levels of a population are a setup for high mutation rates, right? Why? Because you get rare events, right? So it's a low level. It's chronic. This pill, you hit one gene and you stop it, right? So all of these targets, right, have been terrific targets, right? Except we have no drugs to P53. We have drugs for PI3 kinase have just been made. No drugs for MYC. One drug for BCL2, and it's really a bad drug. It's a tough drug, right? No drugs for P16. When you have tumor suppressors and it's loss of function, it's hard to regain a function with a drug, right? But if you have a gain of function, like an oncogene, it's easy to inhibit.
By what you've been saying, especially in the first lecture, why is telomerase not on that list?
Telomerase, which is expressed in all these tumors, right, is expressed at the RNA level. It never was mutant, right?
So it would be the mutation so on the...
It's just an expression. Well, it's an epigenetic change, actually. Yeah. It's an epigenetic change that allows it to be expressed where it wasn't normally. Right?
So in principle, it would be on the list of... It should be on the list of
I
RNA.
Think I, almost all breast cancers have telomerase. Maybe 10% don't. But almost all breast cancers will have telomerase. Yeah. But having telomerase is just the expression of something that normally is off in your body.
I have a technical question. Yes. So when Stratton did this experiment, yeah. That he had to use samples from patients who have not been treated with drugs, right? So, I mean, is there like a kind of...
So what you try to do is you try to... So the way... So a woman feels a lump, goes to a doctor. The doctor takes a biopsy, sends it to the pathologist. The pathologist sees that it's disorganized or whatever the pathologist is looking for and says, this should be taken out.
Right.
It's taken out and the tumor goes to the pathologist and the tumor goes to the DNA sequencer. So she has not yet been treated by virtue of the fact that she's at diagnosis and first treatment is surgery.
So is there like a bank or something, like a biopsy bank in England?
Yeah. So the few cases, and this has been done, of people who are heavily treated with drugs, now, depends on the drug, the chemotherapeutic drugs, the ones that damage DNA and kill cells, those chemotherapeutic drugs are mutagenic. So the tumors, instead of coming out with, we said, 60,000 mutations, come out with 1 million mutations. I mean, they come out with a tremendous increase in mutations because of the treatments, right? And so you begin to worry whether the treatments are actually creating clones that are going to be so bizarre that they're not going to be curable, and that they're the last, your last shot, so to speak, right? But these are untreated tumors. You're correct. Yeah. Okay. It's,
so is there any drug that restores the function, the lost function of P53 or something?
Yeah. So one of the early dreams, right, was to do gene therapy. So why?
Well, that died with leukemia. So.
Well, no. Yes and no. Not yes and no. You could inject into the tumor. It isn't gene therapy that would be in normal cells, but here's what happened. You have to deliver the wild-type gene into the tumor cell, and delivery is a particularly complicated thing. If I just injected DNA into you, you'd degrade it, right? And, I mean, in fact, you do that all the time. You will go out for a hamburger at lunch or whatever, and you'll eat the cow. And the cow will have DNA, and it'll degrade the DNA, and you don't incorporate cow DNA into your cells, right? So at least some of you don't. And so how do you get the DNA in? So the strategy to get it in is to take the gene and put it in the virus. Now the virus could inoculate the tumor, right? I could, if you had a breast tumor, I could inoculate the breast tumor with the virus, and it would spread through the tumor, and it would reproduce wild-type P53, and it will kill the cells, right? It'll kill the cells, especially if I irradiate it, right?
But not all the cells. There will be some cells that are not going to keep growing, so how can it kill all of the cells?
As it turns out, it's not been possible to infect all of the cells, but if you could infect all of the cells, it would kill them.
If you left, they will still grow. I mean,
that's correct.
So you have a little 100% of...
In practice, that's what happens. It's a transient help, right? In practice, if you were more efficient about killing all the cells, then you would be a winner, right? So this was done by a pharmaceutical company, AstraZeneca. And they asked me to sit in on the phase... So drugs get tested in three phases. So first of all, the US FDA, the United States FDA, will never approve a virus, right? And the reason they'll never approve a virus is exactly what happened in this test. And I sat in on this, so I know it was really a zoo. So what they did was they took an adenovirus, and they deleted the oncogenes from the adenovirus, and they put P53. It grew up 10 to the 12th viruses, and they inoculated 10 to the 12th viruses into a head and neck tumor, right? Head and neck tumors are accessible, right? And then they irradiated. Why irradiate? Because you want to make breaks in the DNA. That activates P53, and the tumor shrunk like hell. Just shrunk like hell, right? But now this person, of course, had 10 to the 12th particles of virus in his system, right? And the FDA was really worried about this virus. I mean, suppose it got out and got to Santa Barbara or something like that, right? What would it do, right? What would this virus be like if it got out in the wild? So they said, well, will it get out in the wild? And the drug company said, absolutely not. You're making antibodies against the virus. You'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. So they said, okay, listen, these people aren't in the hospital. We're just injecting them. We'll send them home. But when we send them home, we want to know if all the relatives that live at home with them get the virus. And an easy way to tell is look at their antibodies. If they get the virus, their antibodies will spike, right? So they sent these 5-6 people home, and within a week, everybody's antibodies spiked in the house, the whole household. They could culture the virus out of the toilet, right? The virus was excreted in urine and feces. The virus was excreted all over the place, right? It was going down the tube, then, you know, for everywhere and so forth. So they said, hell with this, we're gonna stop this trial, right? So they have not permitted anyone to do gene therapy of that type with these viruses again. However, there's a Wild West in the world, right? China, exactly. So a company in China decides to do this. And furthermore, the Chinese FDA agrees. And this company, it's not paid for by the social, by the public health service of China, but if you want to pay yourself, you can get injections for head and neck tumors, right? And irradiation, and the tumors shrink, right? And they don't follow what happens to the virus, right? They just don't follow it, right? And they have 400 Westerners come for the treatment. Why? Because if you have head and neck cancer and you're going to die, wouldn't you go to China for the treatment? So they have this film of these Westerners who come in, they can hardly eat or breathe because they're just choked off with head and neck cancers, and the tumors shrink, right? So I thought, this is a gene I isolated. In fact, I think they used the clone we isolated, right? So I don't know. I mean, even if they do use the clone, I can't sue them for using my clone or whatever. So I go visit this company because I think this will be great, right? I show up and I get flowers at the airport, and they take me in, and they show the film, and then they take pictures of me in front of the company with the director and shaking hands and stuff like that, and I suddenly become part of their publicity. Right? Now, what do you do? I wrote them a nasty letter saying I don't endorse this treatment, right? But I'm still part of the publicity. So just by showing up and having your pictures taken, you go back up on the web, right? So it looks as if I'm saying this is really great, and I'm on the web now. So it has its drawbacks, right? So first of all, you're right. No one gets cured. But how much would you pay to live another year?
Kind of the virus.
Answer the question. How much would you pay to live another year? Right? Of course people do it. Of course they do it. Because it works. It's just not efficient.
But then it grows again?
Oh, yeah, the tumor comes back. But you can go back to China if you want. It's not resistant, right? So it's very... So the Wild West is China now. And there's, you know, there's always some place where you're going to find somebody using these kinds of drugs and these kinds of things.
Those people come back to the West with the virus.
They come back on the airplane. They come back on the airplane. I'll give you the airports you should stay out of in China.
So are you the virus?
Do I have the virus?
Yeah.
First of all, let me say, this is a very common, adenovirus is a very common virus. We all have antibodies against these viruses. But none of these viruses has P53 in it. In fact, let me just take you through the math and you'll see. Here's where our friend, the mutation rate of 10 to the minus 8th, is going to come in a hard way, right? They injected 10 to the 12th particles with a mutation rate of 10 to the minus 8th. That means they have 10 to the 4 mutant P53s. Mutant P53s are terrible for tumors. Right? This virus could create tumors, if that hypothesis is correct. Right? So we worried a lot about that, and I said, how do you find 10 to the 4th mutants in a pool of 10 to the 12th viruses? Right? It's needle in a haystack stuff, because the mutant could be anywhere in the gene. So it was a pretty much a nightmare when the company started doing it, and everybody stopped. I mean, people just see the limitations of these kinds of gene therapy experiments now, right? Now, having said that, there are still people who do gene therapy, and they're still trying to get things to work, and there are people with terrible genetic diseases that want to have corrections and so forth. There's got to be a way we can find some place to do that. But
why should the virus confine itself to head and neck? Why wouldn't it just run through the body?
It does. That's what you secrete it out in your urine and your feces.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then if they get an X-ray, they will disintegrate.
No, the tumor disintegrates. They will disintegrate.
Because the virus is everywhere.
So if you inoculate the virus in the tumor, that's where its highest concentration is. But you know, if you're inoculating 10 to the 11th, 10 to the 12th particles, some of it will come out and go in the urine and spread. But it's not every cell in the body that gets this, you know, it's mostly the tumor. And the radiation is localized to the tumor as well, yeah. So you probably clear the virus pretty quickly, right? It may be that some cells have three copies of P53. Often, I once gave this lecture on P53 here, right? as a public lecture, and I was talking about it, and one of the very first questions was from the audience. It was a lay audience, right, in a public lecture that said, how do I get another copy of this gene, right? Why? Because if you lose two copies, maybe a third would help you, right, or a fourth would help you, right? So it turns out too much is not good for you either. So you can make mice with three copies. That's not hard, right? And what happens is the stem cell compartment starts to shrink. So when I did the bone marrow experiment and said, you can't donate bone marrow because you're too old, because you haven't got enough stem cells, right? If you had three copies, you'd be 16 when you failed to donate bone marrow, right? Because too much of it actually starts to restrict stem cell growth, right? And bone marrow transplants. It's like anything else in life. It's what my mother told me, right? What my mother told me was moderation in all things, right? Yeah. A great lesson, even in the number of genes you have. That's why copy number variation is not so good.
Why is it so difficult? I mean, sorry, they were deviating a bit, but why is it so difficult to give the viruses some sort of suicide switch?
Yeah. So people are trying that, right?
Obviously.
And
that, of course,
gets resistant. You get resistance to suicide, right? And this, you know, kind of the fourth survive, and then they amplify up. So people are trying that. Suicide switches you could do that. I mean, actually, originally, one of the very first gene therapies was, you want to kill something, put diphtheria toxin in it, right? That really kills cells. So you put that in, put a gene with diphtheria toxin, then you put it in, and it'll kill the cell. But of course, you don't want these things to get out. The biggest problem is that life somehow has a way of adapting and evolving.
There are non-viral delivery systems with mini chromosomes.
Yes. They're just not efficient. Right? There are liposomes, for instance, are a delivery system. Liposomes are making lipid envelopes that you put the DNA on the inside. It fuses with cells. But you've got to get specificity. You've got to get a whole bunch of things. There's a hurdle for gene therapy. The hurdle is not replacing the gene. The hurdle is the delivery system in gene therapy. Right? And but you could see these tumor suppressor genes, which have lost their functions in the cells, would be great candidates for re-establishing the normal pathway, right? It's just that the delivery systems are really bad. Yeah.
I'm missing something. So if you give the virus without its envelope gene, you cannot make more viruses.
So you have to grow the virus, right? And when you grow the virus, you have all of the capsid proteins, and what you do is you have some catalytic function the cell supplies, and that's how you make it. Yeah.
So
you get on these topics. No one wants to leave them. It's really it's like fantasy world. Yeah.
But so do I basically get the message that
we don't have good drugs?
Yeah, sure. But is the strategy just to go after oncogenes? So the statement is that there are all these things that have to go wrong, and some of them are tumor suppressors and some are oncogenes, and if you can defeat the tumor by going after oncogenes with drugs, why bother on fixing what's broken?
That's right. And so it's much easier to inhibit an oncogene, which has gained a new function, and has catalytic activity. So the lead players, every pharmaceutical company that has any kind of effort in oncology has libraries of protein kinase inhibitors, right? There are roughly 600 or 700 different protein kinases in the cell, and they can inhibit maybe all of them, for all I know by now, right? And those protein kinases that turn up to be oncogenes, you could develop a drug for. Right? Now, it would be nice, actually, if, given the heterogeneity of the tumor, given that there's 72 different kinds of tumors, if every one of them has a protein kinase, a different protein kinase, if I have the inhibitors, I could go after everyone in a personalized fashion, right? That's called personalized medicine, and it would be a nice way. You'd sequence, you'd have the inhibitor, you'd go. But the problem is the pharmaceutical companies have to clear that through clinical trials. And if it's hundreds of millions of dollars to do clinical trials, And so you can't have 600 protein kinase inhibitors approved. If it's $1 billion of money, you have $600 billion just to approve the inhibitors. So there's a real structural impediment to doing the science simply. Right?
Do you think the Wild West will come in here again?
You mean come to the United States?
Not the Wild West. Clinical trials elsewhere are not so inhibited.
Less inhibited, right.
So,
The kinases always come in pair with phosphatases, cycles. Why do we have this list of kinases? Why is there no corresponding list of underactive phosphatases? Why are they not equally lethal as overactive kinases?
So there are a bunch of phosphatases, WIP1s of phosphatase. So that's down here about 13% of breast cancers. There are a bunch of phosphatases which turn out to be oncogenes. But targeting them with inhibitors has turned out to be hard. The specificity especially. What's remarkable is the specificity of protein kinases has got better and better. The specificity of inhibiting one phosphatase and not the other 100 has been very hard. Yeah. And there's another reason. There's two classes of phosphatase. WIP1 is a phosphatase that's a single polypeptide chain. But there's another set of phosphatases called PP2A and PP2B and D and so forth. This is the catalytic subunit, and then there is a targeting subunit, right? So if you inhibit this, you not only inhibit the target you'd like to get rid of, but 10 other targets,
okay,
because there are lots of others coming in, right? So inhibiting the catalytic site doesn't do you a lot of good when you have a common catalytic site and various targets there. Okay, this is probably a good time to stop. I'll do the insulin growth factor pathway this afternoon. It always is the case that, and this afternoon, I think, is my last lecture, I think, almost my last lecture. However, you want to make the announcement about the, or we have made the announcement about the wine and cheese party.
Right, we have 5 p.m.
That's right.
Well, maybe it's better to.
When do it again?
Yeah. 5 p.m. You want to do it at 5 p.m. or you want to do it at start at 4? Because I'll be done by 4 and then we can continue. Unless everybody wants to relax right
at
now.
At the current rate of questions, I think 5 is probably safer.
Well, let's say we can say at the end of the lecture. I'll end the lecture as fast as possible.
Yeah.
It's going to be
into the one cheap part.
Yeah, it's going to be in the founders' room.
Yes.
Let's thank Arnie.